Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht. If you follow me or the podcast at all on social media, you'll know that this year I've published two true crime books. The second of those books, Killer Stories, Conversations with South African Serial Murderers, has just been launched. And I had the pleasure of co-authoring this with Dr. Bryn Hodgkiss. Bryn and I have known each other for 5 years, and you'll hear the story about that in today's interview. And he's now out in South Africa helping to launch Killer Stories into the world. The book is not your average true crime fare in any way, shape, or form. It's a project I'm really proud to have contributed to, and today you'll hear an interview I did with Bryn on Jonathan Bull's PageCast podcast. There are some really cool book discussions on the PageCast podcast, so if you're not following them yet, I highly recommend you do. Without further ado, let's get into my PageCast interview with Dr. Bryn Hodgkiss about Killer Stories. Hello, PageCast listeners. Thank you to Jonathan Bull Publishers for inviting me onto the PageCast podcast today to discuss the brand new release, Killer Stories, written by Dr. Bryn Hodgkiss and me. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, true crime podcaster and author, and today I'm joined by Dr. Bryn Hodgkiss.
Hi, Nicole.
Hi. Bryn graduated from Rhodes with an MA in research psychology. He's worked with the SAPS and the police in the UK. He's received his PhD from the University of Pretoria and now works in England's NHS and is a freelance consultant in the psychology of storytelling. He's just added book author to that prestigious list. Welcome, Bryn.
Thank you so much for having me, Nicole.
It's a huge pleasure. So Killer Stories has an interesting origin story of its own. Where and how, if you wouldn't mind telling us, was the concept of the book born?
I mean, the concept of the book was born when I was doing my MA. I was working with the South African police, and what Mickey Pistorius needed as the head of the investigative psychology unit was somebody to build up the body of research on South African serial murderers. And me being enthusiastic and already like got the bug for working with the police, I volunteered. So I went around from maximum security prison to maximum security prison, speaking to men who had committed serial murder. And one of the things that came across, one of the most common features across all of them, was the role that the stories they told themselves about themselves affected the crimes they committed and helped contribute to them, well, killing more and more. So the seeds of that idea then later became a PhD, but all the recorded tapes sat in a box gathering dust until, as I'm sure we'll get on to, around about 2019.
Yeah. So, and I mean, I guess we can share that with listeners because it's quite an interesting part of the story. So 2019, I stumbled across, I just started my podcast, True Crime South Africa, and I stumbled across Bryn's paper on the internet and read 630 pages of it,
yeah,
well, which is in its entirety. And I was fascinated. You know, it's not common to find that quality of research, you know, available on the internet where people have gone in and done direct interviews with serial offenders. And it really just, I think the narrative psychology part of it really struck me. So I reached out to Dr. Hodgkiss on Twitter, as one does, because I couldn't find him anywhere else. And so I did a public tweet, which we now have on Twitter as our what was happening then and what's happening now. And almost exactly 5 years ago to the day, he replied. And we spent the next 5 years, you know, initially it was going to be, you know, it was going to be a podcast, and we couldn't quite know what we were going to do with this. And then COVID hits, and Bryn, you were quite involved in that in the UK, working for the NHS. And then
I was lucky enough to publish my first book in South Africa, Samurai Sword. And I said to Bryn, I really think this needs to be a book.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's pretty much where it started.
Yeah, and it was like, and what's been really great is as we sort of, we kicked the ideas backwards and forwards, and then Nicole was like, oh, it could be a book. And I was like, well, kind of always wanted to write those. And then as we started doing it, it started to evolve. So we started to bring in more of the interviews with serial murderers than we had first intended. Mm-hmm. And we probably went almost deeper into the stories and into our stories than initially we meant to. But in the end of it, I was really, it just all clicked into place. I mean, the moment when Nicole and I sort of said, let's stop messing around. Let's get some sample chapters. Let's stop talking and start doing. Almost at that moment, Nicole had a chance conversation with Jonathan Baum, who said, we're looking for some true crime stuff. I was like, wow, so glad I collaborated with Nicole. She's famous. She's got contacts.
You know, right time, right place. Yeah.
And that's how, you know, Killer Stories came to be.
Mm, amazing. Stories and storytelling seems to be a running theme through your life and your career. I wondered if that's something that's really come to the fore more in adulthood for you, or is that something that was part of your childhood as well?
Great question, Nicole.
Thank you, Brent.
Yeah, I can see why you're good at this podcast thing. You know, I've always been interested in stories. I mean, I was the kid that always had his nose in a book. Mm. Everyone else would be going to play tennis or cricket, and I'd be finding a nice shady spot to read whatever I could. You know, and then I went to university and I studied alongside psychology. I studied English. And at one point it was a path. Do I follow, you know, literature, or do I follow psychology? And at that moment, I got hooked by the prospect of going into prisons, interviewing people. So that decided my path. And I followed policing for 15 years as, you know, as an intelligence analyst, and then, you know, as a manager. But I think in adulthood, storytelling started to come back more. And it started to come back more when in my day job, I started to deal with more complex human behavior, looking at large-scale change. Mm. And then even more so, and I do touch on the book, where as you get a little bit older and grayer, you start to go, right, what am I here to do? Mm. And I start to realize the power that your own story has to either motivate or undermine you. So I was like, right, this is something I need to focus more on. Mm.
That's interesting. And I think that's we're doing a lot, you know, focusing on true crime content a lot myself in my career. I've found that people are interested in the why of, you know, when they look at serial killers, they are interested in the why. But so often they want that why to come from someone who is what they believe to be knowledgeable, a forensic psychologist, a so-called qualified person. Any why that comes out of the offender's mouth is, you know, in a large sense seen as an excuse by the general public.
Yeah.
So what for you made you want to look deeper at what was actually coming out of the offender's mouth and look for more truth in what they were saying?
I mean, there's a couple of strands. So one was just simply the initial motivation for the research was, how can we use our knowledge of what serial murderers do to profile them and catch them quicker? That was the initial motivation. That's what took me into policing, and that's kind of what I did, not with serial murderers, but with serial rapists and terrorists and burglars and that lot. So there was the very pragmatic, you know, I want to help do this research to make a difference in real life. But then what dissatisfied me with lots of the theory of serial murder I'd read before was, it often seemed to more reflect the psychologist rather than the person. Mm. So if the psychologist had a theory that went, all serial murderers are driven by a, you know, deep, dark sexual fantasy, that was what they then put on all the serial murderers they met. Mm. And the people I was meeting in prison and sitting across a table from, like I'm sitting across from you and having a coffee, those humans didn't match what I was led to expect by the combination of Hollywood and mostly American research. Mm. And you could hear, like, on the tapes, I was listening to 24-year-old Bryn sort of getting a little bit worried and digging, because what the guys weren't giving me what theory told me they should give me. They were like, yeah, oh, why am I not hearing all about these sexual fantasies they meant mm-hmm. to have? And it was only coming back when I started to re-listen to all the tapes for the book. And for some of the tapes, I listened to them for the first time. Mm. That I started to realize that a lot of the meaning in the story was that the meaning in what they were saying was actually on the surface. It was in the story they were telling, mm. you know, and the story actually had more explanatory power than imagining there was some fantasy that was the actual cause, you know. So, you know, so for example, like Sisanda in the book, mm. he's really clear. He says, you know, if you do something to me, for me to feel good, for me to feel okay, I have to lay my hands on you, mm. you know, to hit you or something. And then I feel fine. You know, and that simple definition of who he saw himself to be, because he said, this is how I need to be, because I'm the man, I need to dominate. That more explains how his behavior became more and more violent and worse and worse. It explains it more powerfully than any theory that says, yeah. Oh, no, actually it was because he didn't get enough hugs from his mom. I'm sure mm. more hugs would have helped him. But, you know, but that just simple story he tells himself about himself is very powerful.
Mm, that's interesting. I've been very lucky. I mean, clearly I've been very lucky to meet some very interesting people. It's just written a book with one of them. Yeah. But I've also been very lucky to connect with some, for instance, psychologists who work in the Department of Correctional mm. Services. And I was thinking, it wasn't something that struck me while we were writing the book, but more after it's been published. Do you think that Killer Stories, as we've put it together as a book, do you think that could be helpful to psychologists working within the correctional services to actually help these offenders if they were to look at these individuals from a narrative psychology perspective?
Gosh. That would be so cool. No, I would love if it was, because I'm not a clinical psychologist. I'm a research psychologist. I haven't practiced as a psychologist sort of therapeutically. So it wouldn't be right for me to say, oh yeah, brilliant, it'll help everyone. Mm. But it would be great if it could. Mm. Because one of the things, again, really unexpected as we wrote the book, and the readers will come to towards the end, we spoke with Stefan Skutzier. Mm. Who's an amazing person and should be much more well known in South Africa than he is. Mm. So look him up, everyone. But one of the things he said is, he said, you know what I like about this book is this book would have helped me when I was in prison. Mm. Because when you're in prison, you're looking for stories of people who've made it or stories that you can use to help improve yourself,
yeah,
you know, and make yourself better. And this might help that. And it had never occurred to me that the book might be helpful to someone in that situation. And it would be wonderful if it did help people working with these offenders, because I do think sort of narrative therapeutic techniques are really quite simple. And one of the things that I love about how narrative psychology frames problems is the person isn't the problem, the problem is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And while we can't change our personality, our fundamental personality is very resistant to change. We can't change our life events that sort of wrap around that, but we can then change the story we tell about those things.
Mm.
You know, and you've got a wonderful example in Stefan's, who's someone who's yeah. done that hard work and changed his story.
Yeah,
you know, from one of condemnation to redemption. So.
Mm.
You know, I'd love it if it helped people in that setting.
Yeah, I mean, really, you know, rehabilitation is key. We know, you know, logically, we know that for the most part, serial murderers and certainly people who commit serial sexual offenses are very difficult to rehabilitate. And that was a question that I wanted to ask you as well. You mentioned Stefan's, who is essentially our redemption story. And we know, so Stefan's, the crime he was convicted of was mass murder. So, and your killer stories, individuals are all serial offenders. Now, the difference in psychology between those two crimes, do you think, having put together these killer stories, do you think that there is something in the difference in the psychology between those two types of crimes that makes Stefan's more likely to have been rehabilitatable and to have that redemption story? Or do you hope that the other guys are as likely to be able to have that same redemption story?
Again, a great question. I mean, the reason we put the redemption story in is we realized, like, you know, I believe stories can save you. And I believe the reader should pay it, at very least, pay attention to the stories you tell yourself about yourself, because it can make a huge difference to your quality of life. But then we realized that all the stories we were telling sort of told the opposite. As if you've got a bad story, it all goes downhill and it ends up with you in prison for probably the rest of your natural life. And I was like, right, we need something that brings you up out the other side.
To avoid completely depressing our readers.
And undermining our own fundamental point.
Into Stefan's.
Yeah. So, but it's a great question, Nicole, because I think, you know, what Stefan's did was a single event. And he was part of a group and a community who all supported that ideology. And that no doubt influenced what he did. Although what's wonderful about Stefan's is he at no point uses that as an excuse. You know, when he shapes his redemption story, he's like, yes, I was part of a group, but he's like, I have to take responsibility for what I did. But because it's a single event, because it was part of a group, there might be that difference between a serial murderer who, over a period often of many years, has offended on their own, you following a more sort of intrinsic, like a motivation coming from within themselves. Having said that, like, I would say the one thing they might both share, and one thing that all of the serial murderers somewhat lacked when I spoke to them, is insight into their own story. So one of the stories, like the first story we told the story of Kyle, someone we called Kyle because we had to anonymize all the interviews. And he spoke about the fog. And the fog, he always didn't have a story. Because as soon as he'd start to as soon as I started to question him about something particularly bad he'd done, he would skip away to another topic or change subject to say how good he was and how he helps people. And so his story stopped him ever actually realizing, geez, this is who I am. And there were elements in all of the serial murderers where they didn't quite understand, they had a fog element where even to them, bits of their story didn't make sense. So I would almost say that having that clear narrative of who you are and what you did and having insight is probably the first step to be able to be more rehabilitated.
Interesting.
Because once you can see your story in front of you, you can start to change it and play with it and move the bits around. But having said that, it would still be a very brave parole board that would release someone who'd been guilty of this many offenses over that period of time, you know, out into the community. And parole, as you know, I mean, Nicole, you're much more knowledgeable than I am.
Yeah.
It's such a tricky balance between sort of rehabilitation, punishment, and also sort of public safety and people feeling safe.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely. Yeah. Either a very brave parole board or a very uninformed one.
Indeed.
It's almost, that contrast between the serial offenders' stories and Stefan's story of redemption, it almost made me feel as though a group story imposed on individuals is almost, you know, about the negative story that drove them to their crimes was almost less powerful and more able to be broken and reshaped than the individual story that was told to the individual by themselves. That was more powerful, more sticking, if you
will. And I think, yeah, and I think because the stories we tell about ourselves often are throughout your life, you know, in the privacy of your own skull.
Yeah.
And they become very resistant to change. I mean, I realized, and I mentioned this in the introduction, it's like, I realized actually, because I hit a crisis in my own life, that I had to sort of pay more attention to the stories I was telling. Mm. And I realized that actually then that a lot of the stories I was telling myself about myself were nonsense, but they had been sort of carved into my neurology because I was telling myself those stories from the age probably of six, some of them, six, seven, eight, all through your teenagers, into your 20s, into your 30s. I won't go how far beyond my 30s, but I'm well beyond my 30s now.
Not that far beyond your 30s.
But it is like, it's all of that same thing gets really worn in. And what narrative psychology tries to do is try expose alternative ways of explaining the same events. Mm. Like, for example, if you see a constellation of stars, and I use this image in the book, you know, Orion's belt is really noticeable. You can see it wherever you are in the world. People go, oh, that's Orion, and that's his belt, and that's a sword hanging down. But actually, in traditional Bushman culture, there's a totally different story about the same stars, about three fat zebras and a guy with an angry wife who's lost his spear. So, you know, so the same events in your life wrapped in a different story can have a totally different meaning.
Yeah.
You know, and that's particularly what, you know, what I've loved about stories.
That's amazing. You mentioned earlier the anonymity of the offenders in the book. I wonder if we could discuss that briefly, just explain why we kept them anonymous, what maybe you think the benefit of that is, and then tied into that, we know that there are going to be readers that are going to try and make it almost a game of figuring out who's who. And what would you say to people who want to try and do that?
Well, first, if people want to do that, crack on and have fun, you know, because I know I would have probably done that. So there's no harm if you do. But the reason, the main reason it was anonymous is because when I did those interviews, there was a consent form and an agreement between me as a researcher and the guys as the subjects that they would be kept anonymous in the publication of any academic research and kept anonymous in any subsequent use of the tapes. And that I felt was important to do because that's sort of the ethical guidelines one has to follow as a practitioner in psychology.
Sure.
The benefit, the unexpected benefit, and I only quite realized it when you started to tell these stories, was the person that comes out in the media reports about these crimes is very different from the person's opposite. You like sitting opposite the table having coffee and I'm thinking of Jacques, or sitting next to him on the bench while we had cake, and like the public persona, rather, or the media persona of the person we called Jacques was very different from the person sitting next to me, and similarly for Michael and a number of the others. So that's something I'd like the reader to sort of take on board, is the humanity of the person sitting opposite them. That humanity is what was so important about the stories, is because if they're monsters from another planet, then there's not much we can learn.
Yes.
But they're actually humans, and there's stuff that they've done wrong in their lives, like through those killer stories, that we could learn from as normal, in inverted commas, people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true. And I think that's really with the men being anonymous, they could be anyone. And it's, you know, you don't want that bias of what people think they know about those men to be applied to what we're trying to get across in the book, especially when it comes to the reader then realizing that story is actually not that different from the one I tell myself.
Yeah. You know? No, absolutely. And I know that's going to make some readers uncomfortable.
Yeah. We like but discomfort.
Yeah, we want to lead you into that discomfort. And it's totally true because, you know, you made the point of sort of the narratives in society that affect more or less. But there are definitely narratives in our society that are very harmful. Mm. And you could see it reflected in some of these stories. So like one of the killer stories we called The Victim, like that is a cultural narrative which we see in loads of movies. So like revenge, it's basically a revenge narrative. You know, I've been cruelly wronged and now I can take revenge. And we lap it up in movies. Think of all the movies like John Wick, Taken, even Pretty Woman is like a revenge narrative.
Yeah.
And the reason I would want readers to take, for example, that narrative and pay attention is because it's something that gets used a lot to manipulate people.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it even more on social media and with politicians. It manipulates you to hate somebody else.
Yeah.
And because it's so intoxicating, it's very easy to do. So the more we can notice that, the more we can consciously avoid it or contradict it or know when you're doing it to yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely so true. I can think of so many examples that have, you know, just happened recently where, you know, people are thinking that they are becoming the saviors of someone else who they think is being victimized, but actually they're not being victimized. And, you know, it's that whole victim revenge narrative just goes on this vicious circle with misinformation, and it's so damaging.
Mm.
So you interviewed 13 serial offenders in your initial study. How did you, obviously I had a bit of insight into this while you were doing it, but if you could share with the listeners and the readers of the book, what was the sort of criteria you used to whittle that down to which of the killer stories you would include in the book?
There's always all sorts of clever academic terms I can use about your purpose of sampling. But it was opportunistic. It was like I interviewed just whoever I could easily find within the prison system.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed whoever I could talk to without needing to go through an interpreter.
Mm.
So in my case, it had to be English and Afrikaans or Afrikaans. But then choosing the ones who came from the book, the main thing I chose was people who I'd spoken to for a good chunk of time, but mainly people who had offended predominantly on their own.
Mm.
Although there was one person I've included in the book who offended someone else. The guys I picked for the book were very much sort of offending individually because if you're offending with someone, that you're then dealing with a more complex set of narratives.
Mm.
So those were the guys I picked. Yeah. But also, like, because I'm human, I picked some of the guys that I thought, you know what, I'd really like to explore this person more. Because I remember the interview.
Yeah.
I remember it was like, it blew my hair back or freaked me out. I want to bring that one to the readers.
What was that? I am a bit strange. We know this. I often think about what my younger self, an 18-year-old me, would think about things that I'm doing now. What do you think the 20-odd-year-old Bryn, who was doing, sitting in those prisons, doing those interviews for the purposes of a PhD, what do you think he would say about Killer Stories, the book that is sitting in front of you?
Ooh, I think younger Bryn would have been like, cool, well done. You actually did it.
Wow.
Because I think we, that's weird, calling myself like two people, but it is kind of a bit like that. It's like my younger persona probably always would have wanted to do a book.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, and part of almost what stopped me doing the book was me thinking, well, why the hell haven't I done this sooner? Why have I waited 20 years? But I think I needed to wait that long to really distill what I wanted to say. You know, I hope the younger Bryn would realize, like, okay, actually, yeah, you did need to wait a bit.
Yeah.
Because I know younger Bryn was very impatient when people would say, you've got to get older and more experience before you can do that. I'm like, nah, sod that.
Mm.
forgive the naughty language for the listener, but that was... I think he'd be chuffed.
Mm.
I think he'd be pleased that it's actually out there in the world and that we did something with it that we had always kind of wanted to do.
That's amazing. I think whenever I put something creative out into the world, and I'm sure this is true for many creatives, whether it's a podcast or a book, there's always that excitement beforehand, but it's always sort of tempered with that little sliver of trepidation about how it's going to be received. You know, sometimes that's tinged with some imposter syndrome. Was there a sliver of trepidation for you, and what sort of fears hid in that sliver?
Oh, and I think that Nicole's been kind. She isn't telling the listeners that occasionally I'd be like, Nicole, is this okay? Do you think people actually want to listen about serial murderers, Nicole? No, Bryn, I think it's okay.
Yeah, now I've built an entire career on the fact that people want to know about.
So Nicole nursed me through a number of episodes of self-doubt and imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. You know, because you always think, you know, there's someone else who could probably write this better, or is more qualified, or has worked in a forensic setting, so has done more therapy.
Yeah.
But I guess I just eventually had to, and Nicole and the commissioning editor Jill both said sort of your writing sort of relaxed as we went along the project. Yeah. And I think I eventually realized, actually, this is my story. I can't fob it off on anyone else to tell it. So I really just need to lean into it and go for it. So I think now, while of course I would love everyone to love it and give brilliant reviews and buy copies of the book for all family members who have a bit of a strong stomach, or all the true crime fans in the world. So I'd love a great reception.
Yeah.
But more so, I'm just proud that we got it out there in the world. So, you know, if it does brilliantly, that's great.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't, I'll still be happy that we actually just got the thing out the door. Mm. And I'm proud of how it turned out. Mm. It turned out better than I expected.
Mm. Absolutely. You know that I've said, you know, that I took a lot from the process personally. Mm. And we talk about it in the book a bit. What did you, on reflection, what do you think you may have taken away from the process? And also, what do you hope that readers may take away from the book?
So one thing I took away was, you know, get a good collaborator like Nicole and a publisher like Jonathan Ball, who is, they were flexible and they wanted to bring the best of the story out. So, you know, that made the process very pleasurable. Mm. One of the things I took out, like definitely what Nicole mentions and we touched on the book, how we re-examined our own narratives in the book. Because when I first thought about writing the book, I wanted to hide in the background. You know, I wanted to just tell the murderer's stories, and it was just collected by some anonymous person on a tape recorder. Yeah. But then as we did it, we realized, well, actually, people kind of want to know what it was like. So I kind of got foregrounded more than I would have liked. Mm. So realizing, like, you have to own your own story was great for me to realize. And part of that, the surprising learning for me was how much the narratives in a culture can affect you. Mm-hmm. Because it came out in so many of the narratives that the men told, that the killer stories, you know, in their skulls had to come from somewhere, and that somewhere is the world around them.
Yeah.
But then to the last part of your question, what I hope a reader will take from this, if nothing else, like, of course, I'd love them to be entertained. Mm. If they're entertained and bought the book, that's enough. But just, I'd like as a little bit extra, if they would take away, like, the power that their own story has to affect, you know, their happiness or otherwise. Mm. You know, and then the cherry on top of that, if we're going for, like, the gold medal, is, as I say in the dedication of the book, is listen to other people's stories. Mm. It can make the world a better place, mm. I believe, if we hear more about how other people describe their lives and take that on board as true and not something as we need to fight or compete with.
We had that moment where we came to the stark realization that we were going to have to bring ourselves into this. That was sort of the second time I'd experienced that, because when I started the podcast, I firmly believed I was going to be this anonymous in the background host that no one ever knew. And that clearly didn't happen. And I found and also what was reaffirmed to me through the process of writing Killer Stories with you is that human beings, the bond created through a story is created through another human being.
Yeah.
And it's the bond can still be there with the story, but there almost needs to be other, you know, humans are social animals. There needs to be that other, you know, side to the coin where there is a human face to bond to.
Yeah. And what's been so fascinating as, you know, as it, and sort of both the writing of killer stories and sort of other story work is the role of vulnerability.
Yeah.
Is suddenly you make yourself vulnerable. And what we fear happens is people will judge us.
Mm-hmm.
But what actually happens is people then identify with you.
Yeah.
And identify with you as a human.
Mm.
And that then gives you additional power. I mean, I just see in your podcast, Nicole, like, yeah. A, you know, you're getting all these awards and stuff. But, you know, by bringing yourself to it,
yeah,
people like, they like you,
mm.
and they're more likely to agree to what you're saying. And yeah. Like, you know, and I know you've been a strong advocate for victims and the voice of the victims.
Mm.
People can engage with that, not despite Nicole, but because of Nicole. And that's quite, I don't know, that's been quite nice to realize, you know, it's because you realize you can hide away less from the world because people will like you and like you for.
Yeah. The rights, you know, yeah.
And not just for the facade you give, but for the dumb stuff you've done, because I've done loads of dumb stuff.
Yeah, it's, you know, and so we ended up having to include bits of our personal, well, not having to, but choosing to include bits of our personal lives really to help that bridge between, you know, because let's face it, some of the offenders we talk about in these killer stories have done really horrendous things. And even though they are anonymous, it might be difficult for readers to understand that these could be them. They could be their brothers, their fathers, their, you know. So we hoped, I guess, in sharing those bits of ourselves that it would bridge a reader over to, you know, to, oh, this could actually be me, so-called normal person too.
Absolutely, because without the events that, you know, again, I tried to hide the events at the back of the book that were my sort of bits of personal story.
Tried.
And then quite rightly, the publishing editor said that needs to come more near the front. But if it wasn't for those, I wouldn't have believed in the role of stories as much.
Yeah.
You know, so it's definitely like, I know I told myself my own killer stories and it almost killed me.
Yeah.
So, you know, so thus the killer stories that even the serial murderers would tell have echoes and shadows in all of our stories. So
it's fascinating. And I know a little killer birdie told me that you do still have some more research.
I do.
In your office back at home. And I know I usually hate it when people ask, what's next after you've just published a whole book? But so what do we think is next?
Well, sleep. No.
After that.
After, you know, it's right now I'm forcing myself just to enjoy the moment of, you know, I'm doing a book launch. I never thought I'd be able to do a book launch. So I'm treating it as like a stone I've lobbed into a puddle and I just want to see where the ripples go.
Yeah.
But having enjoyed the process so much, I do suspect like there's tapes that I haven't listened to that I think I'm going to go like, oh, I wonder what's on there.
Yeah.
And wanting to delve in to those again and whether it'll come out in the form of another book would be grand because then I can like start approaching your total or whether it comes out in other forms, we'll wait to see. But I do think I'll be back in the land of stories before too long.
That's phenomenal. It's been an absolute pleasure and privilege, firstly, contributing to the book, working with you. We've known each other for 5 years and we met for the first time on Saturday. That's our books. Which is very strange, but as I said to you, it honestly feels like just getting together with an old friend that I just haven't seen in a long time.
Yeah.
So maybe that's a good thing. Bryn, I'd firstly like to thank PageCast again for having us on. Killer Stories is, unbiasedly, I will say that you really should go out there and get it. If any bookstore near you, online as well. Bryn, before I close out, is there any parting words you'd like to share with the listeners?
I would just like to say thank you so much to Nicole for being a fantastic collaborator. It has been like, it's been like meeting an old friend because we've been, you know, chatting for 5 years and through COVID and through all sorts. So, and thank you to Jonathan Ball and the team there who really genuinely made the stories much better than they would have been had it just been left to me.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much. And just for your listeners is like, go out and find those good stories and spread them.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Once again, thank you so much, Pagecast listeners. It's been a pleasure to be on Jonathan Ball's podcast again. Go get Killer Stories, Conversations with South African Serial Murderers at a bookstore near you or online. And thank you, Dr. Bryn, for joining me.
It's an absolute pleasure.